day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the ACMIPG conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the call, please press star then zero to reach an operator. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. Introducing your host, Mr. William Gardner. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, and good morning to everybody on the call. I want to thank you for joining us this morning, and the focus of this morning's call will be primarily pneumonia. As a way of introduction, we did put all and posted all the agenda in the attachments on the Jenny website, and what you should have in front of you is the agenda. There are two abstracts. There's one entitled Antibiotic Timing and Diagnostic Uncertainty in Medicare Patients, and there's one entitled Delay Administration of Antibiotics and Atypical Presentation in Community-Acquired Pneumonia. There is a PowerPoint presentation, and it's called The Time's First Antibiotic Dose. There's a document entitled Pneumococcal Immunization Law in New York State. There are two data element documents. One is entitled Pneumonia Working Diagnosis on Admission, and that's version 2.0. And the other one is Pneumonia Diagnosis ED Direct Admit, and that's version 2.1. And there's a sample ACM report. There's a document entitled Pneumonia ED Orders, and there's an evaluation form. The first part of our call, Karen O'Leary is going to report on the working diagnosis for pneumonia for July 1st discharges and versus the October 1st discharges. And I'll turn the call over to Karen.
Thanks, Bill, and hi, everybody. For the public reporting portion of today's call, I wanted to briefly highlight some differences in the data dictionary for the pneumonia topic, effective with July 1st and October 1st discharges. Bill has included these versions in the data dictionary in your handouts, which you can reference for this call. For the July discharges, which most of you are currently abstracting charts for, I would just like to remind everyone that the data element chest X-ray has been added. For this, patients will have to have documentation of a chest X-ray or CT scan that indicates pneumonia within 24 hours prior to hospital arrival or any time during this hospitalization. If you answer no to this data element, no further review of the chart is necessary. However, patients will have to have a positive chest X-ray or CT scan and a working diagnosis of pneumonia in order to be in the measure population. To take a look in the data dictionary, as there are many inclusions listed for the chest X-ray data element provided there. For example, infiltrate, pleural effusion, positive infiltrate, pulmonary effusion are just a few. CDAC will accept other terms that will qualify for a chest X-ray interpretation of pneumonia. In addition to the chest X-ray data element for July, CMS did, in their own way, try to clarify notes for abstraction for the abstraction section further. They provided additional information for direct admissions, observation patients, and if the pneumonia diagnosis is found on admitting orders. I'm really feeling like a lot of you, I'm sure, the real fix that we have been waiting for begins to happen with October 1st and forward discharges, and that is that the data element name and purpose changes drastically to pneumonia diagnosis ED direct admit. The data collection question then becomes, was there documentation of the diagnosis of pneumonia, either as an emergency department final diagnosis impression or as an admission diagnosis impression for the direct admit patient? Instead of being a yes or no question as it previously was, the allowable values in answering this are now either one, pneumonia diagnosis in the ED, whereby the physician, NP, or PA documentation that pneumonia was a final diagnosis or impression in the ED, or two, pneumonia diagnosis on admission for a direct admit, whereby documentation that pneumonia is listed as an initial diagnosis or impression, or three, there is no physician, NP, or PA documentation of pneumonia as a final diagnosis in the ED, or listed as an initial diagnosis upon direct admit or unable to determine. So for October 1st discharges, the working diagnosis will not be required to be in the measured population. Only a positive chest x-ray or CT scan will be, and the working diagnosis will no longer be a general exclusion. It will only apply to the admission measures. These are just a couple of the highlights from the two handouts, the two data element handouts that Bill provided. If you want more information or you have questions, hopefully most of you have looked a little bit forward into October, and we are seeing a light at the end of the tunnel with this. And now I'll turn it back over to Bill.
Thank you, Karen. The next item on the agenda is the New York State Immunization Law and an act to amend the New York State Public Health Law in relation to the offering immunization against influenza virus and pneumococcal disease became law on July 26th of 2006 and actually becomes effective on October 24th, 2006. This is just a brief overview of some of the highlights of that law. And basically what the law states is that annually, between September 1st and April 1st, each hospital must offer each admitted patient age 65 or older vaccination against influenza virus. In addition, they need to offer vaccination against pneumococcal disease to each person admitted age 65 or older. And in the context of the law, it states that each hospital shall adopt an influenza and pneumococcal immunization policy, which shall include procedures to identify persons age 65 and older, procedures to offer immunization against influenza virus between September 1st and April 1st on an annual basis, and pneumococcal disease upon admission or discharge, and most importantly, a standing order policy approved by the medical director or other appropriate physician, which shall include, but not be limited to, an assessment for contraindications and a system for documenting vaccine administration, medical contraindications, patient refusal, and any post-vaccination adverse events. We have a very good example of a influenza pneumococcal assessment and administration form on the Jenny website. And this is found under the same section from which you retrieved your agenda and attachments today. And it's posted right in the same forum. So if you'd like to refer to that, it is definitely a good starting point from which to reference. In addition to this, you have recently received from IPRO compliments of the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, an entire binder related to immunization. And this contains information not only on the pneumococcal vaccination, but also the influenza vaccination, the current literature. There are fact sheets. There are documentation sheets. There are medical record forms. And it's an excellent resource and tool for which to administer vaccinations related to the immunizations in the pneumococcal. The next part of our agenda, basically the next two things go together. It's the ACM reports and the ACM site visits. And I wanted to go over basically the ACM report just for a minute, if I will. This isn't specifically related to pneumonia as far as the references to the report, but I did want to share with you some of the findings that we've in the conversations that we've had with facilities during our site visits. As you are well aware, we are in the process of visiting each and every facility that's a part of the appropriate care measure identified participant group, of which there are 57 hospitals throughout New York State. Part of that visitation is really a review of the ACM report itself and an understanding and dialogue with each facility as to what each facility is doing in order to improve their measures in any of the ICM measures, so anything related to AMI, heart failure, or pneumonia. I thought it was a good idea to review the ACM report again, simply because there have been a fair number of questions when we visit facilities, and I wanted to just go over some highlights on the report and basically assure that everybody has an understanding about the intent of the report and how the report can be used. What the document that I'm looking at, it is entitled A Sample ACM Report, and it's the Appropriate Care Measure Identified Participant Groups, and it's dated June 15th of 2006. On the bottom of that report, in that table, table one, on page one, the ranking on the right side of the report itself is a ranking based upon the 57 hospitals within the IPG. And I also wanted to point out and make a reminder that the data on the left-hand side of the report, quarter four, 2004, will always be on this report whenever we send it out. This is the baseline quarter for which CMS has identified that we measure against. So this is always your baseline data and where you are moving towards. So on this report itself, you can see that this facility, if we look at the pneumonia measures in quarter four, 2004, their ACM score for pneumonia was 53.6. For quarter four, 2005, they moved up to 56.1. And their ranking actually changed. For quarter four, 2004, they were ranked 27th, and then they were ranked 41st. So this hospital has a little work to do on their pneumonia measures. On page two of this report, if you look at figure one, your ACM component report, what I wanted to point out specifically on this report is if we look at the heart failure measures on the left-hand side of figure one, you can see that the heart failure measures started at 50.9%, and in quarter four 2005, they went up to 56.8%. You also see next to that 56.8%, you see an expected target. This is an expected target is something that is derived and encouraged by CMS that each facility achieve a 50% reduction in failure rate. And what that means is that if we look at your baseline quarter, and this is what it's measured against, your baseline quarter in quarter four 2004, this facility for the heart failure measure was at 50.9%. What that means is that a 50% reduction in failure rate is that you take the 50.9% and subtract it from 100%. And what you are left with is a score of 49.1%. 50% reduction in failure, so a half of that failure rate is 24.55 or 56%. And if you take that 24.6% and add it to the 50.9%, you come up with a 75.5%, which is your expected target rate. And that's how we derive each of the expected target rates for each one of these measures. For AMI, you see your expected target rate is 91.3. For heart failure, it's 75.5. And for pneumonia, it's 76.8. And that is truly what we're striving for. That's where we would like to have your facility get in working with the ACM IPG is at your expected target. One of the things that I wanted to reiterate also is that this report is specific to your facility. So your expected target is going to be different than somebody else's, just depending on how well you're doing or not doing with the measures. Also on page two, if you see on the right-hand side of that page, there are two different bar graphs, one's on top of the other. And again, that's the missed one cases, and the explanation of that is that had you achieved, these are taking all of the missed one cases for heart failure. So let's take, for example, quarter four 2005. You were at a 56.8%. If all of those cases that missed just by one measure, you were able to improve that one measure, you would have gone up to a 94.6% for that ACM, for the heart failure measure. And if you turn over to page 3, the next question is that, well, which heart failure measure was it that I could have improved upon and had the most improvement for? If you look at the values for heart failure 2, you have a 7.6% above that graph, and that bar graph there. So that's basically the measure that you could improve the most upon, and that's the LVS assessment. So if you were to put together a system of care that consistently recorded the LVS assessment in this chart, you could improve your overall ACM composite score by 7.6%. For this facility, if you look on that same graph, which is figure 3 on page 3, the most improvement that could be had for this facility is in the pneumonia measure. It's pneumonia 2, it's the pneumococcal vaccination, and they could improve their overall ACM composite score by 16.4% had they were they able to focus just upon that measure and improve processes. The only other, there are two other comments that I would like to make on this report itself. Figure 4 is the distribution of hospital ACM composite scores in New York State. This is the distribution curve for all facilities in New York State. There are currently over 200 hospitals reporting public reporting measures in the state, and this is a representation of all of those states and where they are, where their ACM composite score. As you can see, this facility, this example here, their current ACM composite score is at 55%. And what we would like to do is move them to the right as we go along and work in the ACM IPG. The graphs also on page 4 of 5, these again are the ACM performance scores measured against all facilities in New York State. So again, I just wanted to make those clarifications that these aren't just the IPG hospitals. These are all hospitals in New York State, and you can see where you stand in comparison. Each and every hospital has received this report. This is the second time that IPRO has produced this report and submitted it to hospitals. I last sent it about a month ago, and when we have our next quarter of data available, we'll produce the report again and send it off to you. The other thing that's in conjunction with this report is basically how people are doing with their pneumonia measures. And again, the area of greatest potential improvement that we've seen in hospitals is really the pneumococcal vaccination. And we have consistently supported the use of standing orders within facilities. Now we're going to be mandated by New York State Public Health Law to put standing orders in place within facilities itself. The other thing that we did find is that for the administration of antibiotics measure for pneumonia, one of the things that hospitals have been struggling with is how to identify those patients, how to clearly identify those patients and get them noted earlier, triaged earlier, and perhaps get them for a chest x-ray a little earlier in the process. And we have talked to a couple of facilities that have actually done just that, is that if they come in with symptomatic presentations of pneumonia, and it's pretty clear that that's what they're going to work towards initially at triage, is a working diagnosis of pneumonia, they do have a way to prioritize those patients and kind of have a standing order set for those patients. And I guess I want to not say that it's a standing order set, but it's a set of orders that needs to be reviewed by a physician, a nurse practitioner, or a PA, and actually it's an order set that needs to be signed off so that the person can be put in the process sooner. And primarily it's to facilitate getting them to x-ray or radiology for their chest x-ray and getting them back so that they do have a definitive diagnosis. What we've included as an example in your attachments for this meeting is really a physician order set that's used in the emergency department. And actually, this is an order set that comes from Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, Washington, but I think that the premise is the same. It's the same basic information so that they are able to identify a working diagnosis of a little earlier. They have a place for the signature for the physician to get the patient started on this order set, and then they are actually put into the process and gotten their chest x-ray and kind of triaged a little sooner in order to achieve a working diagnosis and definitive diagnosis of pneumonia. I think this is a good example of the kind of tools that facilities have developed, and I think it is useful to share this with the community. Moving on from that, Dr. Stimler is with us today. Dr. Stimler is the medical director here at iPRO for the Hospital Quality Reporting Program, and he is offered to review two recent articles that have to do with antibiotic timing and also the delayed administration of antibiotics in the ER. And at this point, I'd like to turn the call over to Dr. Stimler.
Hi, Bill. Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, fine. Thank you.
Okay, great. I'm going to be discussing a slide set that you should have on, Jenny. And the first cover slide for this reads, Time to First Antibiotic Dose in Pneumonia, Current Controversies, ACM-IPG Conference Call. There are probably two areas of current controversy in the pneumonia indicator set. One of them is among the few indicators that look at blood cultures. That isn't going to be discussed today, but what I am going to talk about are some of the issues that are coming up in the medical literature regarding the time to first antibiotic dose. And I'm going to be talking about two papers and an editorial that appeared in CHEST. CHEST is the Journal of the American College of Chest Physicians, and this was the July issue, last month's issue. Really, the two lead articles try to dispute some of the aspects of this antibiotic delay indicator. The first article by Waterer really tries to go after the evidence base. It tries to weaken the scientific foundations of the indicator. And the second article that was co-authored by Dr. Bratzler looks at a different aspect of this indicator, looking to see how feasible is it really, and is it reasonable to expect a high performance on the indicator in real-world scenarios. So just going along with the slides, I'm going to be talking about Waterer's article first. What he did was he attempted to reproduce in a slightly modified form a study that CMS had done that was the evidence. Actually, there have been two large Medicare retrospective analyses that basically are the foundation for this indicator. What he went ahead and did was reanalyze the data from his institution to try to dissect out what might be some confounders, some statistical confounders that might weaken the case for this being an important indicator. So he did a prospective cohort study of 451 patients that were admitted with community-acquired pneumonia between 1998 and 2001. These patients were fairly typical, mean age close to 60, about half male, half female. And the PSI that I list here, this is the distribution across the cases of the pneumonia severity index. That's what PSI stands for. Now, pneumonia severity index is a calculation from a formula, basically, that is a prognostic indicator for outcomes in community-acquired pneumonia. The inputs to this formula are things such as demographics like age, certain comorbidity status, such as does the patient have liver disease, does the patient have kidney disease, and signs and symptoms of the patient at the time of admission. So does the patient have a fever, does the patient have an elevated Y count, hypoxia, etc. And what the formula does is it takes all these different elements and weighs them appropriately and comes out with a number. Excuse me. And that number basically is puts the patient into a grade, and that grade tells you how likely they are to have a poor outcome or die, essentially. It's a mortality outcome from their pneumonia. Grade 1 would be the best prognosis, and grade 5 would be the sickest people. And as you can see, the distribution across patients who were admitted, and all these patients were ultimately admitted to the hospital, is fairly typical, I think, of what you might see in many hospitals, where most patients fall in the intermediate grades, relatively fewer in grade 1. After all, these patients are less likely to be admitted, and a smaller number in grade 5, which would be the most severe. The diagnosis, in order to be included in the diagnosis of community-acquired pneumonia in the study, you needed first off to have a positive chest X-ray. So that's not on this slide here, but the prerequisite first was to have an infiltrate on chest X-ray. And then if the case had an infiltrate, then as far as clinical findings went, there needed to be at least one finding from Group A and or one or more, or two from Group B. So a patient admitted with an infiltrate who also was hypothermic would be included in the study as a case of community-acquired pneumonia. A patient who had a positive chest X-ray and who had both dyspnea and pleuritic pain would also have been included. So, the inclusion criteria were quite scientifically developed and discrete. Now, the next slide really shows you the first analysis that he did. And this was an attempt to try to characterize the types of patients that experienced antibiotic delays in the ED. And what he did was a logistic regression where he took actually the components of the PSI, the pneumonia severity index, and ran them against whether the patient had a delay or not in antibiotics. So all the factors listed on the left are really status related to one of the PSI inputs. And what you can see basically is he was able to demonstrate that there were four aspects of the PSI formula that seem to be statistically related to the patients having an antibiotic delay. Patients who had an altered mental status, who did not have hypoxia, who did not have fever, and who were of an advanced age, all were more likely, statistically significantly more likely, to experience a delay in the first antibiotic dose. So on the next slide, I've sort of drawn a cause and effect diagram to just illustrate what he's saying so far. He's showing that there appears to be a direct relationship between these four clinical characteristics and a resulting antibiotic administration delay. Now, what he then went on to do was, for the moment, leave this issue of predictors of antibiotic delay and move to the question of predictors of mortality in this cohort. So you see here Table 2 and Table 3. What he did was first look at univariate analyses of predictors of mortality, which meant that taking factors one at a time, just by themselves, study the relationship between that factor and the outcome of mortality. And he took the four factors that we've already mentioned, the altered mental state, advanced age, absence of hypoxia and fever, and also looked at a fifth one, the time, the delay in antibiotic delivery. And he looked at them all one at a time and was able to demonstrate that for most of them, in fact, for all of them except for the absence of hypoxia, there appeared to be a relationship one-on-one between that factor and mortality. So by the univariate analysis, it was very clear that altered mental state was highly related to mortality. In fact, the odds ratio being almost 6 implies that patients who had an altered mental status were almost 6 times more likely to die. But also, you could see that patients who had an antibiotic delay of greater than 4 hours appeared to be almost 3 times more likely to die. So far, stuff, you know, the evidence seems to be supporting, you know, both the importance of clinical factors as well as CMS's own indicator on antibiotic delay. But the sort of the punchline comes in Table 3 and on the next slide, too. And on Table 3, what now happens is he looks at the very same factors, but he does a multivariate analysis, which means that now he's looking for independent effects, which are the factors that dominate the other factors. And what he finds is that you still have altered mental state as being a dominant factor. It's highly significant in the multivariate model with an odds ratio of over 3, which means that patients who had the altered mental status were more than three times more likely to die. But now a few factors drop out. So age, absence of hypoxia, and time to antibiotic delay are no longer independently significant predictors of mortality. So if we look on the next slide, this is really kind of like the cause and effect diagram that he postulates. What you have here is you have four clinical factors that each of which independently predict antibiotic administration delay, and two of which, the ones in red with the red arrows, have a direct effect on increasing mortality. But what you'll notice missing from this slide is that there is no arrow drawn between the green box that says antibiotic administration delay and the red box that says increased mortality, because there is no evidence in his analysis that there is any direct relationship between the antibiotic administration delay and mortality. Rather, there's an apparent effect, but the effect is mediated primarily through an altered mental status. So the altered mental status does two things. It delays the antibiotic administration, and it independently of that increases mortality. So, you know, to try to take this down to a clinical scenario, what this is sort of saying is that if a patient comes in the ER, is confused, and is unable to give a history, then because, you know, there's this confusion and you can't get a history of cough and sputum production or chest pain, et cetera, there is a delay in making the diagnosis. But independently of that, just by virtue of the fact that the patient has an altered mental status, that alone is a poor prognostic indicator for outcomes in pneumonia. And there's pretty good backup for that. There's pretty good evidence that patients who present with an altered mental status and have pneumonia will have worse outcomes, because that altered mental status is very often a marker for both a poor patient underlying biology, but as well it's a marker for a more advanced disease. So that, you know, patients who come in with more advanced disease have more toxemia, they have more metabolic derangements, they have perhaps more of maybe even meningeal involvement. They may have other things that are poor, that predict more advanced disease and that are reflected in this poor mental status. So this is a pretty powerful argument against the CMS indicator, because it suggests that the indicator isn't looking at the most important factor. So the next slide really questions and answers. I guess I'm trying to sort of pick out from the editorial also that accompanied this article, will accelerating treatment for patients with altered mental status improve the prognosis? That's one important question. Another might be is that among patients who don't have mental status derangements, will more timely antibiotic administration lead to better outcomes? And according to Dr. Hauck, who's from CMS, they have done an analysis from the original Medicare cohort and could not find an association between altered mental status and antibiotic delay. Well, if you don't have that association, then you can't have confounding. So his argument is that in the CMS data group, the database that CMS used, this is not a factor. And furthermore, if you do an analysis adjusting for mental status change, you do not change the original finding, which is that antibiotic delay has an independent effect. So if we believe what is said in the editorial, then this may not be a significant issue for the larger Medicare cohort, but I will point out that this has not yet been published. This is mostly unpublished work, so it still hasn't been vetted in the medical community. But there's another question here, too, which is, if you look at the sample sizes between Waterer's study and CMS's study, you'll see that, you know, the CMS study was with tens of thousands of Medicare patients, and Waterer's was less than 1,000, only 450 or so patients. So you have a question of statistical power as well. Would a larger sample size have demonstrated significance for antibiotic delay as a factor in mortality? And we don't know the answer to that. What we do know is that the odds ratio for antibiotic delay in Waterer's study was elevated at 1.85, but, you know, which indicates the potential for an impact on mortality, but the p-value is only 0.11, which is higher than 0.05, so it's not statistically significant. If, and this is part of Dr. Houck's argument, if there had been instead of 500 cases, 50,000 cases, CMS would bet that that p-value would go down to below 0.05. But we just don't know. I'm going to talk a little bit about the second study, too. This was a very different type of study. This is not really trying to go after the evidence behind the indicator, but rather look at the practical implementation of this in the ED. Dr. Bratzer was a co-author. I think that's very important because Dr. Bratzer is one of the primary clinical advisors to CMS on the pneumonia indicators as well as on the SCIP project. So the presence of his name on this paper is an endorsement by him of the paper, its methodology, and its conclusions. And they took 87 randomly selected Medicare charts that fulfilled the CMS selection criteria for CAP, and reviewed these prospectively. They were able to come to consensus. They had a group of expert reviewers doing this, and 86 of the 87 cases were clear enough that they were able to come to a consensus on. And for the 86 cases, they discovered that 67 out of them, or 78%, could have had, they felt, a CAP diagnosis and antibiotics given within 4 hours. That there was enough information present that was clear and unambiguous that clinicians should have been able to get that antibiotic in within 4 hours. But, and this is really the important finding in the study, for 19 cases, or 22% of the sample, there was a potential for antibiotic delay independent of quality of care. So despite, you know, regardless of how good the type of care was that the patient got, for a little bit over a fifth of the patients, it would not have been possible to have made the diagnosis and given that antibiotic within 4 hours. And there were two basic scenarios that they called delay scenarios that explained why this happened in a minority of patients. One was that some cases presented with an unusual presentation, either atypical symptoms, abdominal pain, neurological deficits, ventricular tachycardia, in other words, non-pulmonary symptoms that really were, you know, results of the pneumonia but were not symptoms of the pneumonia itself, or lack of supporting evidence, such as the lack of a positive chest X-ray, hypoxia, or rails. And for all of these patients, ultimately, it became very obvious over time that they did have community-acquired pneumonia, but there was a delay because of the sort of these red herring symptoms and signs. The second type of delay scenario was when a patient came in and clearly had symptoms that were pulmonary in origin, but it was difficult to determine whether these were due to pneumonia or not. They came in with a cough, perhaps, with sputum, perhaps, but the chest X-ray may have been, you know, questionable. There was no infiltrate at the time. You know, so it could have been COPD, it could have been asthma, could have even been heart failure. So these were the two types of scenarios. And, you know, taking a few steps back, they asked a couple of questions that they thought were necessary to at least ask and to try to answer. One was, how likely should community-acquired pneumonia be before the decision to administer antibiotics is made? Should it be, as they've asked in the article, 20% sure? Do you need to be 80% sure? How sure should a clinician be before they actually start, you know, the antibiotic therapy? And they never really quite answered the question in the way they asked it, because ultimately that's a clinical question. So the second question really gets a little closer to it. When does the obvious presence of a pulmonary process, for example, require immediate antibiotics in the ED? You know, a patient comes in, they have a cough, they have sputum. You don't know if they have pneumonia. What should tip your decision-making one way or the other about how quickly this patient should get antibiotics? Is this a high-priority patient, or is this someone that you can wait for the admitting team to come down and make their own decision on? And finally, should hospitals expect to achieve 100% performance on this measure or not, in light of what they found in these abstractions? And I'll give you kind of the way they approach the second bullet, the second and third bullets on of these questions. I mean, and it probably is not a surprising approach. They basically felt clinically that if the patient comes in, has pulmonary symptoms, is unclear that they have pneumonia, and they're relatively stable, they don't appear septic, you know, they don't appear toxic, vital signs are stable, mental status is fine. These patients, low-risk patients, are the ones you can probably wait and you know, for the admitting team to come down and evaluate. They don't need to be put at the very top of the priority list to be seen necessarily before patients with chest pain, et cetera. But patients that come in with a pulmonic process who are hypotensive or who have extremely high fever or who are toxic appearing are the ones that probably need to get those antibiotics in relatively quickly, as soon as you can, even if you haven't come up with a diagnosis of pneumonia yet. So just the presence of a sepsis syndrome that is critical by itself should warrant timely antibiotics as soon as possible, regardless of whether the source has been determined. I think that's just basic clinical good common sense. I don't think there's anything too profound about that. But, you know, that begs the third question then, because if they're saying that there are some patients that you can legitimately wait on in this scenario, then do you really expect to achieve 100% performance? And their conclusion on the next to last slide of this set is that it's reasonable to aim for 75 to 80% performance on this indicator. So that they found about 78% of patients could have, you know, reasonably gotten treated within 4 hours. So they really think that the approximate level of performance on this indicator should really be 75 to 80%. That hospitals should not be attempting to aim for 100% because that can lead to unintended consequences of overtreatment, such as treating patients with heart failure with antibiotics and increasing the levels of antibiotic resistance in hospitals, potentially even leading to epidemics of Clostridium difficile, et cetera. So there are significant hazards of overtreatment, and this article really cautions against that. CMS, as you know, has recently added an inclusion criteria for patients with requiring a confirmatory chest X-ray in order to be included in the sample. That was done, I believe, to try to, alleviate concerns that some of these patients might not really have true, significant community-acquired pneumonias. I have a problem personally because the way the inclusion criteria has been stated, it's not necessarily the initial chest X-ray that is required, but it's just a chest X-ray that's required any time during the hospital stay, which I think kind of weakens the advantage of having this as an inclusion criteria, but that's just my own personal feeling. And I think one of the best things that CMS has done recently on the indicator set is this final bullet, which is that starting in October discharges, there is going to be an additional requirement for all patients that are admitted through the ED with community-acquired pneumonia. As an inclusion criteria, there will be a requirement for a final ED diagnosis of pneumonia. Not just, you know, the diagnosis of pneumonia somewhere in a differential diagnosis, but in the ED department, unless pneumonia or rule-out pneumonia is a final diagnosis, the case will not be considered for this performance measure. So that does tighten up considerably, I think, some of the objections that have been raised regarding the difficulty of being able to identify these patients early enough. And finally, the last slide really doesn't talk about the articles at all, but I was also asked to speak really briefly about some of what we've discovered as we've done some hospital visits. Some of you may already have had a site visit from us. Teams from the IPER hospital team have been going out to many of the hospitals and visiting you and speaking to you face-to-face to try to see whether we can be of any help in terms of identifying areas that you can improve on. And in the process of doing that, we've learned a lot about how hospitals have approached this indicator. And I'd say that there are two general strategies, both of which have been successful to some extent, that I would hope to be able to share with you right now. The first basic strategy that we've seen many hospitals do is really looking at the process, maximize the current process flow. Take a look at the patient from the minute they hit the door to the minute they get the antibiotics and analyze your flow delays. Try to identify weak points in the process. Is there a prolonged time until the patient gets a chest X-ray? Is there too long a reading time? Is there trouble getting the antibiotic down from the pharmacy after the diagnosis is made and the order's been written? Are there other unnecessary waiting times during the patient's sojourn in the ER? You know, are there areas where it's very clear that, you know, you could cut out half an hour of waiting time? So, you know, that's really an issue of tightening up the process. And what we found is that hospitals who do that can get their performance on this indicator at least up to around the 50 to 55%, possibly even the 60% range. Now, that may not seem, you know, terribly high performance, but some people are nowhere near that right now. So that, you know, that's sort of a first stage that you can use. I think in order to try to get up maybe to the 75% and 80 or 80% range for most hospitals, there probably needs to be some application of the second strategy, which is, you know, either adding or diverting, and maybe divert isn't exactly the best way to put it because it's sort of a negative connotation. Perhaps I should have said optimize resources. So let me, you know, just say add or optimize resources here. And what that basically means is that in some way you are tweaking your process so that you are going to prioritize patients who have pneumonia. So that, for example, one approach would be to have the nurses doing triage alert the ED physicians regarding the arrival of a patient that has symptoms and signs suggestive of community-acquired pneumonia. So if a patient comes in with coughing and fever, the triage nurse will immediately inform an ED physician that there's a patient that looks like they have community-acquired pneumonia. You know, this patient needs to be put on a fast track. Now, that's, you know, one approach. To take that approach to the max, I think, a few hospitals have actually hired additional clinicians to handle not necessarily only the pneumonia cases, but they've brought in additional clinicians, and part of the dedicated responsibility of that additional clinician has been to specifically address the triage and management of community-acquired pneumonia patients when they present to the ER. So that, for example, nurse practitioners or PAs can immediately upon suspecting pneumonia in a patient, write an order for a stat chest X-ray, for blood work, et cetera, and perhaps, you know, expedite these processes and follow up very rapidly. And in the case of a positive chest X-ray or you know, the positive complex of signs and symptoms, immediately order the antibiotics and get them started. So, you know, these have been the two basic strategies that are complementary and that have both worked. Those few hospitals that have actually hired additional resources have seen, you know, real dramatic increases in their performance measures, and they've gotten them despite what you know, the article that I discussed demonstrated, some hospitals who've really hired dedicated clinicians have seen their numbers in the 90s. So I think it may be possible to get up there, but it really does take that additional resource. And that's all I really wanted to say. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you, Dr. Stemmler. I do want to allow some time for questions. So, Jim, if you want to open up the lines to see if anybody has any questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press the 1 key on your telephone keypad. You may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. If you're using a speakerphone, please lift the handset before asking your question. Once again, if you have a question, press the 1 key. John Carson from St. Peter's Hospital, your line is open.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
I actually have a question about the new New York State law requiring immunizations. My institution, and I suspect this is the case for many institutions, is going to have a real problem offering the flu vaccine on a September 1st start date. I would say at least half of the time we don't even have vaccine available until the second or third week of September. How is that date decided on, and is there any chance of getting the law changed to make it October 1st?
I'm not exactly sure how the date was decided on by the legislature. There is some discussion about adding a response for the data abstraction element, so that if vaccine isn't available, that there's a possibility that you could put in the answer that it's not currently available. So I don't know whether that's in effect right now. Do you know, Karen?
Yeah, that is not in effect right now. I believe it's going to be option number 6. If there is a shortage or if there's any reason why you're not able to give that vaccine, CMS and or JACA will let us know the status of that and what to tell the hospitals by via a letter out to the hospitals instructing them that they can use this value when abstracting the charts.
See, we've kind of got two different issues going on. We've got a law that's mandating things in New York State, but we also have the CMS data abstraction element, too, that we're trying to, you know, juggle both of these and make sure that they are appropriately responded to. I don't know that I have a better answer for you than that.
In the CMS data abstraction element, what is the time frame that we need to offer the influenza vaccine?
For influenza vaccine, it's October through February that they look for in the data abstraction element.
Okay. All right, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Ann Policastro from St. Francis. Your line is open.
Hi, Ann.
Hi, this is Ken Rubin, the physician advisor at Ann's department. I have a question about the coming change in the CMS inclusion criteria for future abstractions. And I applaud the focus on the emergency department final diagnosis, but I'm a little worried about the rule-out category along with that, because I think that kind of sets us back to zero. So in other words, if you have somebody who's got what you suspect is a pulmonary process, you have a questionable chest X-ray, and now it's a rule-out pneumonia, you know, do we treat that patient, do we not treat that patient? And so I'd appreciate an opinion on it.
Do you have an opinion on that?
Part of what makes it difficult to fully answer the question is that it is a future element, and a lot of times you have to kind of wait to see how the abstractors at CMS actually implement it, practically speaking. So right now what we have is a written description of how they're going to approach this, but we don't actually know in practice what they're going to be, how they're going to lean on one side or the other. What I can tell you is that the best that I, and Karen, please, you know, jump in if you can add some more information too, but they do want to see the diagnosis somewhere in the final diagnosis area, but they're not taking rule out as an exclusion. So in other words, I mean, the best way I can kind of put it together is to say that if in the final diagnosis area at the bottom of the EED sheet, whatever, it says rule out pneumonia as a final as part of the final diagnosis, then that is going to be taken as an inclusion. However, if rule out pneumonia is just appearing somewhere in, let's say, the I don't know, the thing, you know, kind of further up on the sheet where there's, you know, just I guess like the thinking process is, the thinking process is being laid out, or like you say, the triage part. Karen, do you have any more to add? That won't be taken anymore.
That's correct. I know that they are focusing on the final diagnosis or impression, which basically you would see primarily at the bottom of the sheets. You know, that is it. And according to the new data element, that rule out is stated as an inclusion. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, this is an example of how public policy actually forces us to practice bad medicine at times and over-treat, because that's exactly what's going to happen. But I very much appreciate your opinion on it.
Jim, I do want to be cognizant of time, and for everyone on the call, I want to be cognizant of time. I'm willing to keep the line open for a few more minutes if everybody wants that, and if there are additional questions, we'll remain on the line to answer those.
Okay. We have a question from Deborah Cole with Faster Brothers Medical. Your question, please.
Yes. My question or my confusion sometimes revolves around the X-ray report, and it is sometimes ambiguous on what the final impression is, and I'm really uncomfortable interpreting for a radiologist. So sometimes it says things like apparent or, you know, perhaps, you know, there's some consolidation, but I don't know. I shouldn't be interpreting that, and it's not found on the ER report. So in those cases, what am I to do?
Deborah, let me just ask your role. Are you a clinician who would be making a diagnosis or treating the patient? Or
no, I'm an abstractor. I abstract the data for CMS.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that, this is Karen, I think that if any of the descriptor words are used, any of the inclusion words are used, beyond not just the word pneumonia, I would look further or ask one of the physicians that has documented in that chart, because you shouldn't be in a position to make a judgment call to answer that abstraction question.
That would necessitate probably 4 or 5 charts a week going back to the ER and asking them to interpret.
So this is Dr. Stimler. What I understand you're asking is really you want to try to answer the question the way the CMS abstractor would answer it.
Correct.
So the issue really is not that you don't want to fail validation. And I guess... I have two things to say. One is that you need to look very, I mean, and I know you are, but we need to look very closely at the synonym list, the inclusions and the exclusions. And I guess what you're saying is if infiltrate is on the list as being a synonym, or actually, I mean, that is the element itself, but there's a qualifier, perhaps,
right,
or apparent,
right,
then I would say that if you have, that to me those are kind of like equivalent to rule out. So if you have an equivalent synonym, you know, like possible, if you see like possible infiltrate, but on the synonym list there's a rule out infiltrate, I would pick the closest synonym.
Okay.
You know, so like when I hear, and I mean this is, I mean we're getting more into, you know, like sort of English than, you know, which is really unfortunate, semantics, I should say, you know, that rather than actual medicine. But unfortunately, when it comes to abstraction, it does boil down to that sometime. But apparent infiltrate to me is, an, you know, that there appears to be an infiltrate. I mean, I would try to reword, to best understand how the abstractor might approach it, I would, this is not really scientific when I'm telling you, you know, this is more like the art of abstraction rather than the science of abstraction, but I would see if there's a way that I could rephrase it in some way so that it becomes clearer.
Okay, like possible or probable.
Yeah, like possible or probable or rule out, and then go with that to the synonym list.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Donna Barchowski at St. Vincent's. Your line is open.
Okay. It was just in reference to that question that I believe the doctor had a concern about the pneumonia and the influenza vaccine and not having it for September 1st. One of the reasons I'm speaking is that my understanding was the law doesn't go into effect until October 24th. So this year we shouldn't have any kind of issues with having the influenza vaccine for September 1st. Am I correct in what I'm saying?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
Effective date is October.
Okay, very good. So this year we're fine anyway.
Yes.
Okay, thanks a lot. That was it.
Thanks, Donna.
And if there are any further questions, please press the 1 key at this time. We have Lori Baker with Brookfield Hospital.
Yes, hi. This is actually Linda Jendresky from Infection Control. We're trying to implement the program, and some of the concerns about the vaccine from the nursing and physician staff are, is any documentation of any contraindications of giving the two vaccines simultaneously? And can the vaccine be offered earlier in the admission? And I know they talk about patient not being febrile. Is there any time period that you know of, like 24 hours, that patient needs to be afebrile before the vaccine is administered?
Hi, this is Dr. Stimler. Let me approach the second question first, which is really the question about the timing of the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
I want to reemphasize, and you know we've said this a few times, sometimes during these calls, that the concern, and I just want to, many may know this, but the concern about when to give the vaccine is not a patient safety issue. That's clear. Do you agree with that? The real question is whether or not it will be effective. Okay, so, you know, we know that patients sometimes who have another overwhelming disease may not be able to mount as good an immune response, let's say, as a patient who is healthier. So there's been this theoretical, and to some extent there's some evidence to back it up, that patients should be relatively well when they receive the vaccine, if at all possible, to maximize the benefit of the vaccine. We don't, if some people, some clinicians have a concern that if you give a vaccine to someone who is sick, then you'll make them sicker. And I just want to clarify that that's not the concern. That's never been the concern among vaccinologists. The concern is just to try to maximize the benefit of the vaccine. It's a hard question to approach. We've seen hospitals who have decided that they want to give the vaccine at the time of the patient's admission. We've seen a hospital that gives the vaccine the day after the patient's admitted. We were at a hospital that gives it 3 days after admission. We've seen a number of hospitals that have given on the day of discharge. You're really asking a clinical question here. When do I think a patient might be? You know, you're balancing the desire to have the most beneficial outcome from a vaccine with the concern that if you wait so long till the time of discharge, you run into the case where patients might miss getting the vaccine altogether because things are so busy on that day that you can't wait long enough for the vaccine to come down from pharmacy or the patient leaves already. So it's it's a question that you have to take into account. The fact that if you were going to do it on the day of discharge, that might be perhaps initially the most reasonable thing to try. But if you find that half your patients are leaving without the vaccine, then half of them aren't getting any benefit at all. So obviously that didn't work. A lot of the answer to that really depends on your own hospital's processes and how well you can juggle the need for definitely getting the patient the vaccine, but at the same time trying to give it to the best that you can at a time when the patient is getting well. Every hospital has come up with a different solution based on the problems that they've uncovered as they've attempted to do it. Usually by trying to start doing it at the time of discharge and then needing to move further more proximate in the hospital stay because of failures. You know, there are hospitals, for example, they do the screening for the patient at the time of admission, and then they give it at the time of discharge, but then a lot of times people just forget. It's just such a long gap in time. So I don't have a definite answer for you, but I would say that, you know, you try it perhaps at the time of discharge, and if it the trick really is to track your success. If you try it at the time of discharge and you miss a fair percentage of patients, you need to move it up. The other question was what again? I'm sorry.
Is contraindication given the two vaccinations at the same time?
I'm not aware of any. I mean, I think they need to be given. And I'm not a vaccinologist. You know, we actually, I mean, I'm glad you asked the question because we have a conference call series coming up in early September, September 11th, 12th, and 13th, and we are having a vaccinologist on that call, Dr. Pilevsky, who is an expert in, you know, just pneumococcal and influenza vaccines. And I think she'd be the ultimate authority to ask all these questions to. But I know from past calls that given in separate shoulders, that's usually been the answer, that these can be given at the same time in separate shoulder. But I would hold that question for her.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Jim, I'll take one more call.
And if there are any further questions, press the 1 key at this time. And we show no questions in queue.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you, everybody, for staying on the call, and I hope we've answered all your questions. If not, you can always email your question to me, and I will make sure that we receive an answer. We can post those answers and questions on the listserv, on the ACMIPG website. The last thing that I would like to remind you is there's an evaluation form for this meeting that was part of the attachments for the meeting. If you would kindly fill those out, we do take those into consideration when doing future calls. The information to fax those evaluation forms is on the bottom of the sheet itself. Thank you very much for your participation, and have a good day.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.